Okay, and Jim, our speaker getter, will announce the speakers.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim. I'm your grateful speaker getter. So I can only speak for myself on this. I have a hard time doing the right thing, especially when it's hard. So I picked our speaker tonight for two reasons. Number one, he's an alumni of this meeting, but also he always does the right thing, even when it's hard, and it inspired me and has helped me in my program. So I'd like to present Michael F.
I want to thank Jim for lying. David said, "You're going to be good tonight." He says, "You already did the hard part. You lived it." It is an honor to be here tonight with all of you. It was a surprise to me last week when I found out I was going to do this. So I went to some learned people who have time in this program and asked them, you know, how I should approach this. And, you know, I went to my sponsor and he said, "Be honest." And I went to my friend Johnny. He said, "No, really, tell people you really want to lie. You know, I want you to like me. I want to be fun. I want to be interesting." So he said, "Just tell people you're going to lie, you know, and it'll," but I don't think that really works. So I've been taught that rigorous honesty in this program is the only way to roll. But I do know that all my resentments are justified. I want to go on record. I can find a reason for everything. And you can ask my lovely girlfriend, Sharon. She will tell you I can do that. I've been in this program for 10 years, 7 months, 21 days, but who's counting? I'm really not an Al-Anon, you know. But I know that time in program doesn't equal recovery. And I know that you really have to work this in order to get the benefits. I know that I'm doing better than I did 10 years ago. When I came in, it was a pretty sad sight. I came in at 54 years old, and life didn't look too promising going forward. And the road ahead was a lot shorter than the road behind me. So for the newcomers, I hope you hear something tonight. I hope you hear part of your story, because that's what hooked me. I heard part of my story falling into a meeting in North Hollywood at Colfax and Addison on March 15, 2005. And I heard part of my story. And then a month later, I went to a speaker meeting over at the Church of the Chimes. And I heard a man share who brought me to tears. And he waited at the end for me after he met everybody at the end. And he spoke to me. And he gave me the 5 words that were, "You're in the right place." And he brought me up here. And that's Jack, and I'm grateful to him and his family. And all the men in this room, because I learned from all of them in here. And I thought I'd start with a little bit of recovery before, you know, I got into my story. I'll give you a little family background. Obviously, I'm not from West Covina. I come from a little area called Astoria, Queens, New York. And we have, I have one brother in here from Queens somewhere. He's not here tonight. He knew I was going to be here. I grew up in an Italian family in Queens, New York. And I looked it up today that the Italian word vendetta, it's an Italian origin or a Latin origin. The Latin origin is vindictive. And the, or vindictus, and the word vendetta comes from that language. And that permeated my family over the years. And when I read the definition today, it was really retaliation for a murder in the family and the entire family. Like, in other words, they didn't just go and find the murderer, but they murder his whole family. And it's an interesting little thing. You know, we didn't have murder in our family. I'll just want to go on record. A lot of other criminal activity, but no murder. None that I would admit to here anyway. The family came over from Italy back in the 1920s, and tough times for those people. My father's family came from money, but my mother's family came from Sicily, and they came over on, they came in steerage, you know, and that was a long boat ride. Growing up in a bilingual family, I know there's nobody who really understands that in California, but growing up in a bilingual family in New York was very interesting with my family because it became a secret code. And with all the prejudice that was going on for Italian assimilation into society back in those days, they didn't want us to learn the language. They wanted us to become American. And with that came all this, the secrets in the family, because everything was hidden, embedded in this language. And a lot of things I didn't really understand. And it really affected my trust issues over time, and I'll get into a little bit more than on that. But one of my grandfathers, and I start with the grandparents because when we look for that family tree and we're going to shake it, we got to find out where the alcoholic is. And my father's father was a 5'7", redheaded, 140-pound ice man from Brooklyn. Now, for those people who were too young to understand what an ice man is, it's not a hitman. He actually carried ice. And not only did he carry ice, but he used to bootleg his own grappa and wine. And he was a tough guy. He was a really tough guy, and you had to be tough in those days in order to be able to deal with it, the society in that time. Year 2000, I went to Italy, and I went to find my family, my father's family. And I went to this little town in northern, not quite northern Italy, it was like central northern Italy on the Adriatic. It was originally a retirement community for Roman soldiers. They even had an amphitheater where they used to fight gladiators in the back in that day. They didn't have golf, you know. They had to fight lions. I went back to see it, and everything's still there. The imprint is still there. It's pretty fascinating. And, you know, I also found out that my grandfather was illegitimate and that I found my real surname. I had no idea. All these years, I had no idea that it was quite different than what I have now. The name I have was given to him by a priest when he was baptized. And so he was this little redheaded child, and he gave him the translation in English would be Little Leaf. And there was a lot of shame attached to that in the family, and the people that I met were the people who were the adopted family of my grandfather. They were the descendants. And they were very, very wonderful people, you know. It was difficult to find them. I mean, I had no idea because none of the names match in the family. Apparently, when I got back to New York, a lot of my family knew what was going on, my uncles, but they would never tell me. It was all kept in the closet. Nobody wanted to know about any of this stuff. My grandmother was just, she was the matriarch. My father was one of three brothers, and he was the oldest of three. And he stayed at home during the war. He had bad eyesight, so he didn't have to go. The other two guys went. He supported the family. And it was a very, very tight-knit group of people. My grandfather was a very, very controlling guy. He was a very scary guy when I was a kid. He had a mean dog named Rexy. And that dog was, we were told as children, never go near it. He was the only one that the dog was afraid of. And it always amazed me that how he would just walk in the room and the dog would just like bow down. And that's what he wanted from everybody, including my grandmother. So I could this whole thing of fear was an undertone in the family. Same thing with the other side. My mom's side, too, was that. My grandfather came around the same time in the 20s, and he became a contractor in New York and lost everything in the Depression and became a sweat hog and built the Tribeca Bridge and had to raise 7 kids. Pretty tough in those days. And, you know, I learned more about my family after my mom's passing, which was pretty insightful. But I'll move on to that in a minute. But bless you. My father was a real warm-hearted guy, hardworking. This is a guy who would get up 5 in the morning, come back 8 o'clock at night. He drove a truck. He worked in the same place for 44 years. Never drank a beer once in a while. My parents did not drink. My mother had a few drinks and she got funny. It was the only time that I would find her to be funny. otherwise she'd be one tough woman, you know. Mom grew up in an atmosphere with, she was the middle child of 7. There were 3 boys, then 4 girls. So she became the caretaker. She became my grandmother's aide. She became the translator. She was someone who would deal with the creditors when they called during the Depression looking for... they had a phone, actually. It was amazing during the Depression. They had the only phone in the neighborhood, I heard. And she would have to deal with the creditors. My mom's mother, my grandmother, she grew up in a convent in Sicily, and the story goes that she was very ill. She contracted cholera and somehow cured herself. Her sister was a nun in the convent, and she was raised by her sister. So she came to the U.S. in steerage, and they raised a family together. And during the Depression, she became a midwife. She was a healer. She would set broken bones, do all kinds of stuff like that. So these were really good people. I mean, I don't really have a lot of that kind of horror. The horror came later in the family when I learned that my grandmother, my mother's mother, was beaten by my grandfather when he came home drunk. And how I learned about this was that after my mom passed, I had a long talk with my godmother. And she would tell me stories how, when she was a young girl, how she would wait up at night for my grandfather to get home, and she could tell by the sound of his walk coming up the path whether or not someone was going to get beat that night. And she would run out and she would try to make him laugh so he would be misdirected. And I went, wow, I really never understood that. As it turned out, he beat his wife, he beat his boys. He didn't beat the girls, but he beat the boys. I had one uncle who became a gambler and an alcoholic. One of my aunts became, my aunt, she's very colorful. She was a bookie in New Jersey at one time. She did a little time. And my father used to go there and visit her once in a while when he'd go to Jersey, and he would walk into the house that they lived in, and they had, at that time, they had jacks with phones in the wall. They had about 20 people running in around pulling in numbers. And then they got raided one day, and they used to use flash paper to put the receipts on so they could burn them in the toilet. And she couldn't get rid of enough of them, and apparently they got a few, and so she got busted. But it showed up there. It showed up in her behavior and gambling and very, very sad life with her. My father's side, it was similar. My father's father was such a control guy with his kids, and there was all, like I said, all these secrets. You know, we're as sick as our secrets. And the kids carried into their marriage. And what would happen for me is that I would spend a lot of time with the grandparents. It was this thing where, you know, with this tight-knit family, we all lived within 3-4 blocks of one another in New York. So on the weekends, we'd spend with either one of the families. And the Sicilians were fun because they were, my grandfather was always loaded and there was music and, you know, there were lots of kids running around and animals, and they had a little, they raised a lot of vegetables and fruits and all kinds of stuff in this urban neighborhood. And that's how they lived. But the other side was a very uptight family. And my grandfather had a way of permeating the room and making everybody feel uncomfortable. My two uncles married women who were not Italian. And unfortunately, my mother was the only one who understood the comments my grandfather would make. And if anybody knows anything about the Italian culture, Sicilians are not necessarily accepted as Italian. And it doesn't really exist that much today, but it did back then. And my grandfather would make disparaging remarks about the daughters-in-law. And my mother would understand him, and then she would get in his face. So there was what we used to call a scene that would explode. And then I'd be rushed out the door with my mom and dad, and then my mother would get into it, my father, for him not defending her and not standing up for her. And this existed my entire life. And this is where everything really started to crumble in my family, the arguments. You know, it's funny, I talk to my sponsees about this a lot because a lot of them have children. And when people are going through relationship issues, we talk about the kids a lot because it's really important that these kids are not part of that. Seeing it growing up like that, you know, it's not exactly the best model for a relationship for the future. There was no hope in there. And my way of making decisions and picking people for relationships and my expectations from people were very distorted. So as life went on in the family, it just became more and more anxiety-ridden. I couldn't deal with it after a while. So while mom and dad argued, my father being a trucker, by the way, I only learned later as an adult that he had a secret life on the road. That was a whole nother issue, and my mother was a great detective. My mother, God bless her, you know, she was a stalker. You know, we lived in Queens, and she would take a cab to the Bronx because she thought he had an affair up there, and she'd sit outside a window. It was like Scorsese, and you know, I'm just gonna sit and wait in the cab and look at the window. And that's the kind of woman she was. She was really, and I got that from her. She became the rager. She was the rager. Mom, I'd like to say she was the victim, which she was, but she represented her life as a martyr. And that was very, very tough. That's a behavior, boy, that really, really sticks. And so I learned the language of Vietnamese. I didn't learn Italian, I learned Vietnamese, you know? And it's a very, very hard language to interpret because your perception is completely distorted. There are multiple definitions for the same words, you know? And, you know, I realized that she only wanted the best, and she wanted her kids to be the best we could be. I know that. But her method of communication was very, very coarse and very, very difficult to digest. And so I went off on my own path. You know, my parents wanted me to have a great education. They put me in parochial schools, and I did that for 12 years, all boys high school. What a nightmare. You know, it was, you know, I had the brothers in high school, and they weren't the brothers, if you know what I'm saying. It's like, it was a whole different cult, and the principal of the school was an ex-Marine DI, and there was a certain, again, fear, control. They wanted me to be a certain way. So that's where I got my God of my understanding then. That was the God to fear. It wasn't the God who was going to be my partner, you know. And I dutifully went to school and did what I was supposed to do. And then did 2 years in college and did what my parents wanted me to do, and then I bailed. Because in my teens, I had met someone in my neighborhood who would become a big influence in my life. And he was a child prodigy musician who was going to performing arts in Juilliard. And I got infected with music and in the arts, and started moving into Manhattan because that's where the life was. That's where there was a future. Manhattan was exciting, and Queens was boring. You know, it was all blue collar for me, and I just couldn't. I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to do what my father did. I was going to do something different. Not that there was any disgrace in what my father did. He worked very hard, and he made a good living. And as a matter of fact, back then a truck driver's salary was actually decent. And he raised two kids. And we had a house, you know. I didn't have to really want for anything. I do remember there were times, because Dad was a Teamster and there were strikes, and he would take other work and we'd be eating hot dogs. And I'd say, Mom, why are we eating hot dogs? She says, don't worry about it. So I didn't think anything of it. But I never really had to want for much. It was always there for me and my brother. They were good that way. They wanted us to have the life that they didn't. They didn't want us to suffer like depression babies did. And I followed, you know, their direction for as long as I could, until I was doing gigs and coming home at 2-3 in the morning, and my mother was locking the doors and screaming at me and everything else, and I'd sleep in the car. And then finally at 19, I bailed. I moved in with my girlfriend into Manhattan. Now, during all this time, the girlfriends I was picking, my picker, oof. You know, my self-esteem was so low, and I was so looking for a way of being accepted and having such a high standard in family to live up to, you know, especially with my mom. No girl was ever good enough anyway. If she was Italian, she wasn't from the right town. Yeah. You know? If she was Irish or she was some other ethnicity, she would have a problem, you know? And then when I bring girls home, my mother had a collection of tools. She had a collection of wooden and steel spoons, and when the girls would come in, she would open the drawer and she'd say, this is the way I raise my son. My mother had a philosophy of, when I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. Do as I say, don't do as I do. You know, it was very, very odd. So I didn't bring girls home anymore. So at 19, I bailed. I moved into Manhattan with my girlfriend. Now, the girl I moved in with, I had had a relationship with. And this is very, very tough for me because this was my first real sexual experience. And she came from a family, both mother and father were functioning alcoholics. At the time, I had hair down on my shoulders and a mustache, you know, Fu Manchu mustache. And Jack and Janet, her parents, were very interesting people. They had a place up in Phoenicia, New York, if anybody knows that area. It's up near, just north of Woodstock. And Jack and Janet would like to drink, hunt, and fight. And it was a very scary proposition for me to be around them because, you know, I would go up and stay weekends with them up in Phoenicia, and Jack say, come on, we'll go out in the dune buggy, we'll go shooting. You know, kids with long hair back in 1968, it wasn't really kind of cool to be hanging out with people like that. It was scary. And when they would get a little loaded, I didn't know, you know, you had to make sure that you weren't near the guns. And I was too afraid of being lost in the woods. And they were, and Janet was a good shot, too. Janet shot the biggest bear in the Catskills. I saw the news headline in the New York Post, you know. Hippie found dead on Route 28. But Diane and I had we were two kids, both with parents with issues, and it was us against the world. And Diane got pregnant. This was 1969, 70, and this was New York. I didn't know what to do growing up in the my religion of my family. The moral issue was a big thing. But I didn't have a part in her decision at that time, and she made a decision, and abortion became legal in New York. Just became legal in New York, and it was fortunate that she was, for her, she made that decision, and she was able to be medically taken care of properly. But I lived with that decision for the longest time, and it was a very tough one for me. She was okay with it, but now that I look back on it, her self-esteem had to be, if not as low as mine, worse than mine. And as life turned out for her, she had a very tragic life. She was a heavy drug user. She became a heavy drug user. But we were all doing drugs back then, so it didn't look like anything, you know. I mean, I smoked enough weed that I'll never get glaucoma. So, but I didn't have the allergy. And as life went on, we moved to Brooklyn, and we broke up shortly after that, and then my career started. And what gave me validation was my career. For what I was doing, or for what I had been doing, it was all encompassing. I was so absorbed into it. The atmosphere, the people, the technique, all the skills that I couldn't be involved in anything else. So relationships became peripheral. It wasn't something that I was pursuing because I was so absorbed into what I was doing. I was working 100 hours a week. And I did that for a number of years. I did that for almost probably 7-8 years straight. And I didn't care. I had nowhere else to be. It was more interesting to be at work than to be in my life. So the distraction was very cool. And I liked to smoke weed back then, but I would never get high when I worked. For me, it was about showing up and being a pro. And there was so much to think about and so much to prepare for that I didn't want to screw up. So it gave me some sense of discipline for myself to be able to focus on what was important for me. Now, mind you, of course, I had this loneliness and always looking for, some sort of a relationship. But, you know, I was always on the other side of the clock. You know, I wouldn't get out till midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, which is not late in New York. But you're not exactly meeting, you know, people who are well-adjusted, normal. And it was, it was a lot of waitresses, it was like barmaids, and, you know, I'm in all these clubs and whatnot, and because I don't have to be into work until like noon the next day, so, you know, why go home, you know? And back in those days, back in the mid-70s and the 80s in New York, it was rocking. And you could find trouble, you know, and I did. But it was always this empty feeling, you know. I was into serial monogamy because it was, I know it's kind of funny because I think about it now, and having that kind of an attitude, I was more or less figuring out where girls lived and how close to work they were. And if I, 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was like, hey, you awake? And can I drop by? I didn't want to go back to Brooklyn. It was always hard getting a cab back to Brooklyn. It was tough getting on a train. And, you know, and I was a bit of a rogue, and it wasn't a good thing. But I was always nice to the women I was with. I was never cruel. It was never nasty. It never wound up well. And I had a major fear of commitment. Gee, I wonder why my parents, in their situation, I said, Jesus, I have to be married? I got to be like that? That ain't going to work. That's not good for me. Terrified me. Really terrified me. And especially when they started mentioning the M word. And I go, really? And that was tough for me. And it was no disrespect towards them. But after a while, I just had to say, you know, if that's what you're looking for, then I got to move on because I can't commit to this. My career was too important to me to do that. And finally, it got to a point where I became bicoastal, or bi, as I say. And it was New York, LA, and I had an apartment in Brooklyn, and I had an apartment out here, and I was traveling back and forth. All I needed was a briefcase. I didn't even need a suitcase after a while, and it was perfect for me because I was totally, my life was in transit, and I didn't really care about much. But, you know, it's funny because you don't always think that these things matter, you know, because you're doing something, but there's no growth. There was no growth for me. I was spiritually declined. So now I get to the how I got here. I had a client I was working with who had a girlfriend that he was living with for about 11 years, and then they split up. And I get a call from a mutual friend, and she says, listen, Chris is, Chris and Gary split up. And I said, really? And she said, well, listen, would you be interested in having coffee with her? And I said, yeah, you know, and so it all started. Chris was this really sweet girl, fun-loving, you know, her ex was in a major band, and she did 6 world tours. So she knew everybody. She was comfortable around men and artsy people and whatever, and it was all good. And she was a fun hang, smart, smarter than me in a lot of ways, and very outgoing. She was very personable. She was a cute blonde who told dirty blonde jokes, you know, and she can make people laugh. And she was comfortable in her own skin doing it. So for me, we started dating, and we got pretty serious, and then one night she was having dinner with her mom, and I came to meet them, and she came out to meet me before I walked into the restaurant. She says to me, so listen, I told my mother we're getting married. I said, you did what? And she said, well, I had to tell her something. And I said, yeah, but why did you tell her that? And her mom was this really sweet farm lady from Oneonta, New York, I walked in and she was so pleased, and I said, yeah, it was great news, isn't it? It was kind of new for me too, you know, and so we got married. Wow. my career was in the toilet. I had no money coming in. You know, we went to the Diamond Center in New York on 47th Street to get a ring, like in one day. And we set up a wedding. And, you know, this is tough, but the wedding was tougher. I mean, you know, to see all my old relatives and to see, you know, everybody's happy for me after all these years. I was 39. And everybody was waiting to see this was going to happen. My dad was in tears. So the wedding was pretty interesting because my cousin married us. He's a priest, and and she shows up 2 hours late. We had a hurricane, and she showed up 2 hours late. But I don't think that was the reason. I think that there was, you know, her hair wasn't right or something, you know. So at any rate, I'll move on because I only got a few minutes left. It's going quick. I get an offer to come out to California to move here, to relocate. A corporation recruited me, and I started a really high-pressure job that would last 11 years. And so we moved to Los Angeles. We got married in October. We moved to LA in December, and it all looks wonderful. We have a beautiful house. We're entertaining people. It's all good. And then 3 years into the marriage, we start having problems. We start having communication problems. She was about 3 years younger than me, and her clock was ticking, and she wanted to have kids, and she wanted to do all these other things in the meantime, and my fear of commitment was getting in the way of all this. And communication was breaking down, having problems. So we started, of course, couples counseling and learning how to communicate. We start doing that, and then 1993, it's really going, we're getting it together. Should we break up for a minute? Really for a minute, like overnight. She decides she's going to come back. 94, the quake happens, January 17th, 1944. And if there was ever a warning sign, it was that quake. Because within 30 days, less than 30 days, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And we were at Valentine's Day dinner, and she said she found a lump. And I said, she said, what should I do? I said, well, did you get it checked? I said, she said, what if it's something? I said, if it's something, we'll deal with it. Well, that something turned out to be something. She started, you know, the normal course of surgery, chemo, radiation, the whole deal. And, you know, she was doing okay for a while. But anxiety struck, and she was terrified. She was so terrified, the poor girl. And her her mom came out. Her mom lived with us for over a year. And we got through all the chemo and the radiation. I never forget, we were in the radiation. It was OJ on the TV. And it was his wonderful chase scene. And all the technicians, it was so surreal watching the technicians watch this while we're in there for radiation, you know. And we got through it. I went to all the chemos with her. We did pot parties on the way home so she wouldn't get sick. I had registered nurses give her shots of Compazine so she'd get through it all at night. And we got through that. That took like another year, 2 years. I'm having problems at work. I'm in a high, you know, I went through four regime changes in 11 years. And a lot of pressure. I get into this situation where she's acting out and I don't know what's going on. And I can't understand the behavior. And I see this behavior, which is condescending, it's rage, she's erratic. Well, as it turns out, she had sprouted alcoholism. She was addicted to prescription anxiety drugs, painkillers. She was on a diet of Ativan, Vicodin, Xanax, Valium. Meanwhile, what I figured out, she was dealing cocaine for some of her friends. And I found all the bottles, and I did all of the Al-Anon things. I went through everything in the house, and I'm leaving, you know, leaflets about the addictive behaviors of Ativan. And, you know, we can do this. And, of course, I have experts in the field because I work in the entertainment business. And it was, so I called all my AA buddies who had, you know, 20-some-odd years and say, listen, can you fix this? Can you take care of her, you know? And there were some people who actually did that were very nice. And then there were some people who came around for me. And I go, well, I don't have a problem. What are you talking about? Well, yeah, you don't have a problem. Why don't you come to this open AA meeting with us? I said, yeah, but I don't drink. I said, no, everybody smokes there. I hate being in those meetings. And they said, no, you should come. So they give me my first big book in the 12 and 12. And they tell me, you know, listen, just read it. Well, it sat on my shelf until I got into these rooms. So what happened was October 26, 1999, she says to me, listen, it got to be so bad, and she was getting violent with me. And I said, what do you want to do? She says, well, if you love me, you let me go. So I walked out. Within 3 weeks, I filed for divorce. And within 2 years' time, she was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer and went to her spine and brain. And we were in the middle of a divorce, and we tried mediation, and she come loaded to the mediation meetings, and I couldn't get anything done. My divorce attorney drops dead on a tennis court. I mean, it was crazy. So I understand she's got the cancer. Oh, and what do I do in the midst of all this? I take a risk in the company, and I start my own company. And it becomes moderately successful. And then I find the celebrity's daughter and start dating her and going over to Paris and all kinds of places. I was nuts. I was completely crazy. And I find out, she says to me, how we found out about her metastatic cancer was, she said, she called me up one day and she was sober and she said, listen, I gotta go for an MRI. Would you come with me? I'm scared. So I call my attorney, and my attorney says to me, well, if you do that, that's a reconciliation, and it's all this. And I said, you know what? I'm doing it. Now, I wasn't in program. I had no program. And I said, I'm going to go. So I do it, and we find out. And she says to me, look, I don't want to continue treatment. They had already put her on tamoxifen, and it was making her ill, and she didn't want to do it anymore. She says, I don't want to do this anymore. And she had, in the midst of all this, she had 3 suicide attempts. And I was at Cedars more than 2-3 times. And she said, I'm not going to continue treatment. Would you be there for me? And I said, well, you sure you don't want to continue treatment? I said, we have some money. I said, if you want to look for Lorenzo's oil, I said, I'm happy to give it to you. She said, no, I'm done. I said, okay, and I agreed. So I brought her mom out here. I set up hospice care for her. And I spent 18 months with her going through all this, and it was very painful for her. Thank God for hospice, because the woman they sent to us was an angel. She was actually from my old neighborhood in New York. And she was a very, very cool lady. I'm still friends with her today. And, you know, it's funny. After all of that, after everything we went through together, being angry at one another, after all the drugs, after all the pain, you know, I had no idea what to do. And I had nobody to help me. And her oncologist said to me, he says, listen, I can't talk to you about her medical stuff because you're in divorce proceedings. He said, but I'll tell you this. He said, you need to do whatever you need to do now to get on with your life thereafter. And I made a decision at that point, and I said, I'm going to do this. And I got through with her, and we became friends again. We became the two people who met one another. And I was able to help her get through it with as much grace and dignity as she deserved, and to do the right thing. Now, again, I still had no program. And I only got a few minutes, and I'm just going to do that pretty quickly because most of you guys know me. And how I got in the program, like I said earlier when I started, I got in March 15th, 2005. And how I got in was that the walls were closing in on me. I was sitting in Studio City in a house I lived in, and I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to talk to. I was in a lot of pain. I was scared. I had no work. I felt like an outcast, and I was alone. And many years before, I had lunch with a colleague, and she talked to me about ACA. And I had no idea. I said, well, I'm not an adult child of an alcoholic. So I went and looked up the A's online, and I started looking at, you know, all these support groups for AA, whatever. And I found Al-Anon. And I said, well, this looks interesting. People who've been affected by alcoholism. And I found a meeting in a neighborhood, and it was at 7:30 on a Tuesday night, March 15, and I walked in. I hid out in the back of the room. I was terrified. I'm usually pretty comfortable around people, you know, talking to people, etc., but I was terrified. Big ego, low self-esteem, you know. And I sat in the back of the room, and at the break, there was this tiny little literature lady named Thelma, if anybody knows who she is. And Thelma looked at me, and she saw how scared I was, and she was tiny, you know, and she had this little June Allison voice, and she said to me, so she tried to sell me something, you know. So I come into this room, I think it's a cult to begin with, and she's going to sell me something. And she says to me, I think you should buy this book. It was One Day at a Time, The Daily Reader. And she said, keep coming back. And she made me feel safe. And I kept coming back, and I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. They told me try 6 meetings. And then I went to that Church of the Chimes meeting where I heard Jack speak. It was a speaker night. And he made a difference in my life and brought me up here. This is the room I grew up in. This is where I got to find out who I am and who I'm not. Where I knew, where I learned here what I had to be responsible for and what not to be responsible for. And I learned about myself. I learned that the coping mechanisms of my childhood became the character defects of my adulthood. I learned in here that my solutions made my problems look good. What I learned about myself was that the pain of where I am outweighs the fear of where I'm going. And then only then I take the next indicated action when my back is to the wall, when the wheels are falling off. And, you know, only recently I heard something else, and I heard it from Jack as well, which is that, you know, what I am responsible for today is I'm responsible for my first thought and my second action. And that my first thought and my first action are always rooted in my disease. And I'm always going to make a bad decision because my perception is skewed. And what this program has given me is the opportunity to have a shift in that perception. And if I don't know what it is to admit that I don't know. And call someone up and talk it out and find out where I'm at with myself in order for me to make the best decision, to be well informed. And, you know, I can only pass that along, and I can only show people how someone with recovery would act. I have no control over them. I want control. I fight for it all the time, you know. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm that same old guy. You know, if I don't go through a litany of things that I need to do to prepare, whether it's journaling. I've been journaling since August 1, 2000. And it helps me to get it off the hard drive and put it somewhere where I don't have to carry it around for me because it'll kick around all day long. And it's bad information. I don't go back and look at it most of the time. It just gives me a place to put it where I don't have to carry it around and I don't have to tell it to somebody else. So for all you people who've come in here and you're in pain, well, you're in the right place because this is the only place I can find relief and I can find peace, where I can make better decisions for myself and behave in such a way that I can be happy with myself, with where I'm not feeling skittish about my decisions or saying the wrong thing, knowing that I can be an adult and the meaning of what it means to be a man. And that's why I learned here, because the men in this room are amazing. When I hear the stories of the men in this room and what they get through and how, you know, it was as said earlier, we don't shoot our wounded. You know, we carry guys over the goal line here, you know. We go to court, we take them to hospitals, we do whatever needs to be done. Nobody's alone in this room. That's the first time I ever felt like that. And I didn't know that anybody else thought the way I did. My God, like-minded people, as crazy as I was, you know. I mean, God bless Jack, you know, he has a dangerous job and he answers that damn phone, you know. And I got to ask him sometimes, you going through fire? And he says, no, I can talk. I'll call back. No, I could talk, you know, or Willie, you know. But so many of these men and what I learn in here. So I'm grateful. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity. It's an honor. And I hope you heard something tonight that has some value for you. Thank you. Yay.